You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is the 28th of April, 2021. Today, it's very difficult to actually pick a topic. So much of, as I said in the lecture on envy, so much of what the fathers talk about on social things, not theology, of course, but on social matters, comes from a society that not only doesn't exist anymore, but by comparison to this one there is no comparison to this one. The church fathers almost couldn't conceive of a society like this. They didn't have the language. They didn't have the conceptual apparatus to understand a society like this, because we were born into it. I was born in 1971, and so, I mean, the worst possible time period. This stuff seems natural. This stuff seems normal. You take someone who was born in 1800, let alone 1200, and bring them to the United States and have, or God forbid, send them to a university for a month. I always said, what would happen? You take a very strict church father on moral matters, like John the Faster. Send him to Harvard for a month. Let's see what he says and what he does. What he says about American society. What he says about, you know, how we're to deal with this corruption. Even words like corruption, destruction, auto demolition. None of these are really. None of these really fit. I think at an absolute minimum, you can't say even that moral rules have fallen apart. They haven't. They've just been replaced. 20 years ago, the regime would talk about relativism. Now they talk about absolutism because their moral ideas are in charge. And they're applied ferociously. I simply don't understand how an American white male could possibly function in college. I barely, you know, as a straight A student, I barely made it through from 1990 to 1993, 89 to 93. I have no idea how a young white male is going to do it now. But it's not just a matter of staying silent. You can't stay silent. You absolutely have to join the regime and say what you're supposed to say. One of the worst parts of it, and I experienced this firsthand more than once, that when you come under attack, it's absolutely, absolutely bitter. And there's nothing you can do because there'll be no one to defend you. Conservatives are some of the absolute worst people to ever deal with. They're petrified now. What a conservative does is adopt what liberals believed 40 years ago and spout it as natural law or tradition today. They spout slogans. I hear them already talking about the Clinton era as a time of intellectual virtue. I hear them talking about, you know, whether it be Martin Luther King or the Black Panthers as, you know, legitimate civil rights organizations. You know, by comparison to what you have now. Listen to a conservative talk about Black Lives Matter. He'll never say, of course, White Lives Matter. He'll say all lives do. Well, not all. I mean, I don't matter, but other than us, all lives matter. Then they'll say, well, that's not a very good organization. Black Lives Matter, because they're not like Martin Luther King, who, of course, was a deity. They'll say the same to far more radical groups. They'll say the same of Al Sharpton. This is what conservatives say today. Conservatives are making the exact same arguments that leftists made 30 years ago. 30 years ago, if you remember, the debate was whether or not you should have, you know, certain, homosexuality on television, condoms in schools. These are the kind of issues. And the first thing that the regime would do is they'd have their liberals and libertarians come out and say, well, this is censorship. You can't keep people from this. And they would condemn it. You know, well, any morality code and on the radio or anything else, they'll say it's this is censorship. We need to have free speech. Now, of course, only conservatives are making those same arguments. Ask a conservative why he dislikes pornography. Just go up to them. I guarantee you the first thing they're going to say is that it objectifies women and we can't have that. Anything else, it is irrelevant. They're not defending. I remember when Bill Bennett, God, it was 20 years ago, said we need to abandon the abortion argument. We need to talk about divorce. Forgetting that Ronald Reagan was the one who signed the first no-fault divorce law in California. So they're abandoning all of this. They'd be the first one to condemn that, what I think is largely a fake Westboro Baptist Church. And their signs aren't false. The signs are okay, but I don't think it's, you know, that church is bizarre. How big is this? You know, they have protesters in every major city. How are they not shut down by now? How do they have so many members? They show up and get the money to fly and all this. This doesn't make it. I don't think that's a real thing. I'm pretty sure it isn't. Our people would have been smashed. You know, any protest from them would have been shut down violently right away. Every time they would have, and they'd be arrested for something. There'd be nothing left of them. And yet, wherever they go, I mean, it hasn't been since COVID. Hasn't been a lot of them, but every little thing, and some of the most bizarre elements. One of my favorite singers of all time, Ronnie Dio, one of the greatest rock singer in history, had his funeral protested by those people. He never said anything demonic. He was a medievalist. I have evidence of that. He was deep into medieval imagery. He never made a political or religious statement in his entire life. It's weird. It's odd what they pick. In other words, they choose to attack things that they know will get them under the most vicious attack, and then Christianity is attacked right afterwards. I've explained to you how the Catholic priest molestation scandal is make-believe. If you go to bishopsaccountability.org, you will see every accusation made against Catholic clergymen from 1945 to today. And you will see that 1% have led to any convictions. Most, in fact, I mean, maybe 5% led to an arrest. There was no probable cause, even. So obviously, if there's no evidence, the church has absolutely no reason to harm the clergyman. The internal investigation, there's nothing. Now, I converted out of the Catholic Church. The theology, of course, is one of the most liberal institutions in the world today, with the exception, up until recently, on abortion. It was the only organized institution that was willing to fight abortion and the facts. They've been neutered completely because of that issue. It's make-believe. The Judaics, of course, have a far worse record. The public school system has a far worse record. So these are just examples of the make-believe that's out there, the nonsense that's out there. And now, of course, the Church of Rome, following this current pope, believes in absolutely nothing. I'm telling you now that one of the worst jobs in the world you could possibly have, and of course all the conservatives are a part of it, either some mainstream mainstream Catholic or Protestant organization, anything else is extreme, is to defend the current pope. It's absolutely impossible. You have conservatives all over the place who do everything in their power to defend him. Conservatives talk about how necessary it is to spread liberalism abroad, which actually is the topic I wanted to deal with today. This show has become either a philosophical, theological show on the one hand, or dealing with foreign affairs on the other. Generally speaking, I don't make a distinction between domestic and foreign policy, because globalism is a reality. It's enforced. Globalism is, of course, based on liberal finance capital, and it's defended by every conservative out there. And just before I change topics here, one of the things that drives me the most insane, and you guys know what I'm talking about, is this blaming communist China for everything. I've heard these guys on Fox News literally say, in English, believe it or not, that Black Lives Matter and the censorship stuff, that all comes from communist China. Black Lives Matter is created by the Chinese. I've heard them say this with a straight face. You know, it clearly it's a substitute for something. We know that there's a relatively small group in control of this. Well, they can't say what it really is because they live in terror. So they create a substitute. And they create a substitute that's based on Johnson's Law, because no one knows anything about the Chinese Communist Party. Therefore, they can invent whatever they want and say this is what they're doing. They won't talk about central banks. They can't talk about Judaics. They can't talk about the race hucksters in America. They can't do that. So they figure, well, what can we do? They support war with everybody. So the only thing they have is either the Russians, the liberals take, or conservatives take the Chinese. So the regime right now is dividing the political system it's created into liberals are supposed to hate Russia, conservatives are supposed to hate China. Both enemies of the regime. So war with either one will, and they'll be able to mix and match because they're allies. Very few people even know that. And one last thing, I just can't keep this is. There was a conservative, one of the human events types. I forget who it was now. I don't want to think about it. They had an article, breathless article, saying that big tech is involved in censoring right-wing views. This is like a month ago. Big deal they're making of it. They just heard of this. And how awful it is that the abstract rights to free speech championed by the French Revolutionary movement now is being violated. They still think that corporations are conservative. See, I can't figure out what is the worst. There's so many things that are ridiculous, just absurd. I can't figure out what the worst. Communist China might be. The corporations are liberal. The military is conservative. That nonsense. But I'm starting to wonder. I think the worst is that. And you've heard this. You've all heard this before. Someone on Fox News will say, we know that the election, well, they don't even say that anymore. Fox News is too scared. So someone, you know, vaguely conservative publication will say, we know the election was fraudulent. We know that the voting machines, the way the regime operates, but we can't do anything about it, obviously. It's all fraudulent. Therefore, to fight this, we have to get our guys elected to Congress and the presidency. Now, if you don't understand the problem with that, just click off now, because you're not going to understand anything I say. You need to go someplace. There's places for people like you to relax and get waited on hand and foot. They're just, you know, if you don't see the problem with that idiocy, I can't imagine. I mean, the people who listen to me from the regime reporting on me, they're well aware. I don't know, maybe there's a few people. They say, and then classic conservative thinking, they'll say, we know that the electoral system is totally fraudulent. Although, again, a lot of them are backing off on that. But in general, they're saying, we know the electoral system is totally fraudulent. We know that the presidential election, and they even mentioned like the one in Georgia that happened right afterwards, we know that this is make-believe. We know what the media does. We know the blatant violations of the law. We know the media's role. We know with voting machines, there's a million things you're going to go through. Totally fraudulent. Of course, there's nothing we can do about it. So to fight this, we have to make sure that we got our people elected. Now, I guess part of the problem here is that they are so bereft of ideas. They really have no theory. Most of the time now they're just libertarians. They don't know what else to be. Being a libertarian is safe because it keeps you from ever having to take a political opinion at all. Well, everything's okay. Everything, you know, everyone's pursuing their own interests, so what difference does it make? Including censorship. Censorship is someone very powerful pursuing their own self-interest, so why would you be opposed to it? If that's their fundamental ideological dogma, of course it is. You can't sit there and say everyone is pursuing their self-interest, this is a good thing, and then condemn people who become powerful that way, pursuing their own self-interest politically. I mean, even the libertarians talking about capitalism, they can't talk about how awful it is that the government regulates these conglomerates as if government and corporations are two different things. They'll even admit that government does their bidding. Government will, you know, write, you know, laws that, you know, especially in the foreign realm, subsidizing foreign trade. The concept is once they get a certain amount of power, they're able to subsidize themselves. They can privatize profits and socialize costs. You know, they're aware of this, but they'll still talk about government and capitalism as if they're two separate things. They're not quite at the point yet where they have to hold that it's bad for the government to regulate corporations, but corporations are the government. They haven't quite gotten to that point. You see a few libertarians who've reached it. They're usually on some kind of psychotropic because, you know, if they have any concept of cognitive dissonance, they're in a lot of trouble. But even if that's true, all it is major billionaires pursuing their self-interest and buying off government apparatus or creating it. Still, there's no problem from a libertarian point of view. It's a ridiculous ideology. For the most part, it typifies conservatism. The idea that we only want legal immigrants. That's what we like. And you'll hear them. This is the same idiots who say, I don't care if a man's black, brown, or purple. You know that ridiculous, ugh. Can you imagine people talk like that? And they're waiting for applause, I guess. These are the same people who will talk about, they're the same people who say, you know, from my cold, dead hands. I love this with the gun confiscation. No, you will meekly hand over your gun and condemn everyone who doesn't. I saw that on the front lawn the other day, that sign. If you have anything to lose, you're going to hand, what are you going to do? Barricade yourself in the house? Anyway, the notion is that immigration, legal immigration is okay. Then they're not vulnerable to being called racist, which is the worst thing that could possibly happen. And, but then of course all the regime has to do is say, okay, we'll just make legal immigration, easy. Or we'll just eliminate the border entirely as libertarians want. Okay, so what's your argument now? They only do it for the sake of virtue signaling. I'll never forget there were several conservative columnists. You remember when Sam Francis died? Always was a big fan of him. He was an academic, too. Conservatives, there was a bunch of conservative columnists who were applauding his death and how awful racism is and how we have to do something about it. We believe in a level playing field and legal immigration. That was 20 years ago now. Now, this, what I'm talking about here, I'm kind of all over the place because I can't wrap my brain still around the fact that you have entire political movements, conservative ones, or claimed to be, there's no doctrine of conservatism at all, that hold these arguments and that make these arguments out in public. We know it's because they simply have no ideas. We know that they're scared. They're middle class people. They're usually white collar. Now you have a few upper level blue collar, mostly white collar. The people who condemned that couple in St. Louis for defending their property. I mean, conservatism tends to be lower white collar now. They have no ideas. They simply have nothing to replace the current regime. They're terrified. They don't want to lose what they have. They'll spout these slogans. They'll talk about, you know, from my cold dead, oh, that's cold dead fingers. Yeah. Yeah. You're going to barricade yourself in your house with your pistol, making a last stand. I'm dying to see what these guys, you know, every once in a while you go to, like when I was on Facebook, you go to some of these pages, like the conservative pages, guys who don't even use their real name will talk about how we're gonna take action. You know, we have guns, whatever. And of course they're immediately condemned by conservatives. They should be, you know, that's kind of stupidity, should be silenced right away. But they're spouting it for applause. They're spouting it to sound militant. They're spouting it to express frustration. But they don't actually mean a syllable of it. Unless you guys really have, like you have young kids or something like that, you need to use your real name. That's starting to get to me. You know, being terrified of the regime while calling yourself militant on the other hand is problematic. I understand there are a very few good reasons to use a pseudonym. But what that says, you know, pseudonyms are a problem because you don't have to take responsibility for anything you say. So it's a problem automatically. I understand there may be various, you know, people in the military, there's specific things that may, you know, I mean, if you're FBI, I'm pretty sure you should use your pseudonym. Otherwise, you really shouldn't. They're going to find you anyway. And it's just at this point, you know, maybe there was an argument 20 years ago. At this point, it's just, it's a sheer fear. You guys know I've been through the mill. I've lost everything at one time or another, and I'm still here. So, this just kind of reflects the utter chaos, the era in which we live. I can't figure out what the worst, most bizarre aspect of conservatism is. Calling yourself a conservative is ridiculous. You have these people saying the Republican Party is our friend because Donald Trump was a Republican. You know, this is where we are, because Donald Trump is far from any kind of, you know, he's... The man can't possibly be happy. Well, his life is pretty much over. He was elderly to begin with. And if that man can survive what he's been through, then you guys could use your real name. So, this has just been, this introduction has been very chaotic. I'm all over the place because I just don't know. I'm running out of vocabulary words to describe what conservatism is, what the mass ignorance is, the mass fear. And you know, liberals are frightened as well. One of the ways that radicalism takes over, and radicalism that is always being redefined. Radicalism comparison to what? You know, conservatives would be considered far leftists if this were, you know, 40 years ago. But radicalism always wins. The far left always wins because they can make sure that liberals say to themselves, well, we have to absolutely fall in line, or we're going to get fired, we're going to be kicked out of the movement, we're going to be whatever. In other words, you have young university professors getting a job in history departments. They're liberal, of course. But once they get a job, they're looking for tenure. What they have to do is start getting more and more radical to make sure that they can never be accused of something. The tiniest thing that they may say, any joke that they might utter that's taken even slightly the wrong way, they look at a woman the wrong way, anything, anything, the slightest little thing can be taken and blown up in the media to be that this man is a monster. The only way they can get around that is, you know, almost physically attacking white males on campus, putting up stuff on their office door, you know, what we're going to do, how wonderful Black Lives Matter, they're not militant enough, you know, white people's lives are forfeit. This is what they have to do. They didn't start off that way, but in order to prevent some joke later on to be interpreted and destroy his life, he has to get more and more radical and just try to forestall that, and it never works anyway. So that's what's happening. Conservatism is in absolute disarray. It usually is. But it's in complete disarray now because as it stands, the Church of Rome, there are no principles. They have nothing. Conservatives have not a single thing that they stand behind. They have absolutely nothing. They'll even continue to tell you that private corporations can do what they want. They could censure whatever way to private corporation. We stand for capitalism, right? So, I mean, they must also think that they could search their car. Maybe they could come to their employee's house and take their guns away. They could censure. They could do a lot of things. You know, they could violate any legal provision if they could violate that one. You know, they could search your car if they could censure your the corporation itself. But again, these examples, all of these that I've listed here of cognitive dissonance, examples that it's hard to even express because our language just isn't descriptive enough for it. So an intellectual disarray that, of course, is planned, it's, you know, the Quicksilver and the Masonic vocabulary, the dissolution, so they could remake it. Think of the remaking is already being done. The absolute moral laws are being established, and they're being maintained with violence. Conservatives realize that if they say the wrong thing, even slightly, Black Lives Matter will be on their front door. They know they could have all the guns in the world. They touch one, and he's going off to prison, even if the house is being attacked, as the St. Louis example told us. But fear and dissolution is what maintains control as of right now. You're still kind of in the... we're just at a time using the French Revolutionary example. We're pretty much at the Napoleonic phase, the Bonapartist phase, where they've consolidated their power, and now they're going to use it to launch the revolution abroad. So this is what Marxists would call the Bonapartist phase of the revolution. The first phase, of course, is dissolution. The second phase is laying out what the new moral rules are going to be, and the third phase is a militant and military control over it, where even those, you know, the Russian Revolution, you had the Octoberists. They kind of were monarchists, but were liberals and everything else. So then they redefined what conservatism was. They redefined what traditionalism was. It's just a slightly less violent version of themselves. And that's how it worked in France and Russia. That's how it's working here. So, therefore, conservatives are a very important pillar in the regime, and they should be treated accordingly. Given the fact that they use this kind of... They're involved, their cognitive dissonance is so severe, you won't be able to reach them in logic. Really, only parody is the only way you can do it. Pointing this stuff out and laughing at them probably is all you can do. And maybe at some point, you know, they'll lose their job. The economy is falling apart. They'll either kill themselves or they'll start to understand. And when I say kill themselves, I don't mean put a bullet in their mouth. I mean, they'll just remove themselves from any political or intellectual life at all. Suicide can mean a lot of things. It's not just taking poison. It's not taking care of yourself. It's deliberately falling apart, simply not caring anymore, withdrawing yourself from any, that's the same thing. It's usually not as dramatic as, poisoning yourself. It's, they're far less dramatic versions of suicide. But initially, before I got on this topic of the insanity of conservatism and the dissolution of all intellectual life in the U.S. and the Western world, I wanted to talk about the notion of Bonapartism relative to foreign policy. The difference, of course, between the Napoleonic era after the French Revolution it's part of the French Revolution, and our era now, is that there certainly are no Napoleons. There's no one with that capacity. The big difference between any revolutionary state that follows this trajectory and today is that you have no, the culture producers, the white male, is reduced to absolutely nothing. No culture can be produced. Nothing of any value really can be made. There's no production. The Napoleonic era saw nothing like this. There's no money. The military has been crippled. There's no room for someone like him. Or Zhukov in the Soviet Union. There's no room for anyone like that to develop. The military has been purged. There really is no one, but it may take different forms. The Anti-Defamation League, the SPLC, the big universities, the major media, probably major media more than anything else, will then be the ones to clamp down on any dissent and create foreign policy. So it's not an individual. It's a set of institutions. It's the regime as a whole. Major media control every aspect. They create foreign policy. All the understanding, you listen to congressional debates, and all their understandings come from media reports. Every Senate congressional office has CNN going on for 8 hours a day. You've all seen it. It's constantly being pumped in. They control political terms, what's important, what isn't. They control what reality is. Beyond that, though, they're simply aspects of capital. There's only a handful of conglomerates in the West, whether it be loosely or tightly bound to one another. They're like universities. They have hundreds of corporations, orbiting around their center. The oligarchs know one another, and they're always meeting, they're always in contact with one another. And in one form, one way or another, they control every aspect of capital. You see what happens when someone goes off the reservation. You see what they're going to do. A few owners of, an NFL team that says something even slightly off color, and they're going to, they'll destroy them. So that's the way the Napoleonic element seems to be working itself out here, is that you have, basically a committee. You have corporate capital just taking its media form, using street violence or the Red Guards to spout their, destroy resistance. That makes the whole Napoleonic comparison difficult, because you don't have the military force. You don't have the you don't have the high command, and you don't have any standards for them anyway. The regime did so much damage to military organization that a Napoleon or a Zhukov can't come into existence. What could happen is if the regime gets itself into a war with Russia or China, there's a chance that suddenly they're seeing a lot their world fall apart, because the U.S. will be clobbered. We wouldn't know that, but it would be in reality. Someone like this can show themselves and get all of the veneration from the elite that someone like Napoleon would get, or Zhukov would get. If their back is up against the wall, you'll see, you know, someone like Ariel Sharon getting that kind of power. But the infrastructure isn't there. The money isn't there. Even you know, where the money goes, I mean, there's no auditing of these people. So where we stand right now, the whole point of this half-hour discussion is understanding the situation now has vague connections to the Bonapartist era in revolution, in comparative revolutions. But it's very different. You don't have the resources. You don't even have the energy. I mean, you have nothing but lethargy. You don't have the energy to back someone like that. I think of someone like Zhukov. Well, if there's, you know, an invasion, if there's a badly bungled war, the regime may suddenly realize that, you know, strict hierarchy and conservatism and traditionalism and military may be the way to go just for that. Stalin did the same thing, you know, at least in a symbolic form. But the notion of basic thought, the chaos of conservatism, means that there are no centers of resistance. There is not a single institution or any money center that has a capacity to stand up against the regime as it stands. Again, you had it very similar in the Soviet Union, and yet the place crashed down. Conservatism is easy to make fun of, to parody, to point out their absurd, you know, lapses in logic. But what isn't easy, what isn't funny, is what it represents. I just published something. Some of you may have seen it on my Patreon account. It's not quite been published yet. I just published something on Rafi Hariri. It's kind of like the final judgment, except in this case, the assassination of the Lebanese leader in 2005. An extremely important, most people don't know it, but most people don't realize how significant that event is. And the other being the string of Israeli losses in the Middle East. Since 2000, Israel has been defeated over and over again. They still, of course, have the reputation as being this invincible force, but this is far from the case. Over and over again, they've lost. Hezbollah, and of course the Iranian connection, is becoming the most successful resistance movement out there. And extremely popular over there. During the so-called Cedar Revolution, which was the color revolution in Lebanon, the protests against it, against people, you know, Hariri's people, the liberal, you know, Cedar revolutionaries, the protests against them were 10 times the size of the protests in favor of them. You see, I saw that in Syria too. Before there was a shooting war a few years ago, the pro-Assad protests were huge. Yeah, they were in six figures, and they didn't get very far. They, you know, maybe 30, 40,000 for the others. You had some mainstream media coverage of the pro-Assad movement, but then that faded off to give the impression that, you know, that he had no support. And of course, he won an election shortly thereafter. But now in Lebanon, during the Cedar Revolution, you had a Shiite protest in Beirut carrying portraits of Assad, by the way, that numbered 1.5 million. And that was published by none other than the Washington Times. Now, the color revolutionaries there had no more than 40,000 at their largest. Now again, Washington Times published that one article. It was never mentioned again. And I'm seeing this in terms of the color revolution. I'm noticing, and it's the same thing domestically, I'm noticing that it's pretty blatant how unpopular these movements are. the American media and these analysts and academics, they're awful. But they actually hold to the view that even if sanctions actually works and does damage to the host economy, that the protests are violently opposed to the government rather than being opposed to those who impose the sanctions. The whole, I mean, just one nonsensical idea after another. You'll hear it both in Russia and in Iran that this massive percentage of the GDP is based on oil. In Russia, it's something like 8%. In Iran, it's not that much higher than that. I think it's 18 or 19. They have an incredibly diverse economic base. The tight control of information is absolutely essential. The conservative mind today accepts that as true. They'll still quote the New York Times as if it's an authoritative journal, which of course it's not. It's absolutely ridiculous. You don't have skilled journalists working there. You don't have analysts who know anything working there. And again, it's very easy to poke holes and make fun of them. That's really all you can do at this point. Needless to say, as far as the conservative movement, they are 100% pro-Israel, and therefore actual resistance movements, domestically and foreign, are backed by Iran and or China and need to be destroyed. There was, and I mentioned this in print, maybe around the election, that you had an entire liberal set of articles blaming Iran for election interference. That was roughly around the time when Trump looked like he was going to win. That was dropped very quickly. And now, of course, conservatives are claiming that the Chinese communists have done this. And that's kind of one way you can tell where the frauds are. Those fighting that tend to, you know, just take what I say and, you know, put it in their own words and promote it as their own. But that's kind of a way you can tell the difference between the two. Anyone who talks about elections seriously, anyone who talks about the Chinese Communist Party controlling America, I mean, this is how you can tell where people not just are brainwashed, they simply they have no ideas. They don't know how to think this through because we live in absolutely unprecedented times. I said early on, Church fathers wouldn't be able to conceptualize this society. And they talk about social realities, virtues and vices. They're still assuming a basic, very healthy society. And that doesn't exist. Even the use of words isn't stable. We are in a completely unprecedented situation. This has never happened in history before. This has never occurred before, where even the nature of reality is dissolving, which, of course, is in the interest of the regime. But people aren't even using words. They pick whatever they want as far as definitions go. That's never happened before. And it's extremely difficult to go to the ancients or the medievals for guidance when there is simply no way that they could have conceived of this. You go to them for guidance, though, to define what healthy is, to define what logic is, because the very definition has been going on for a long time. You know, I was forced to read critical race theory in grad school 20 years ago. You know, it makes me laugh, these conservatives who will, you know, say a few very guarded criticisms of critical race theory. They just discovered it yesterday. I'm going to get lectured to about Antifa, a group of people that I've been fighting physically for, God, decades. From conservatives who just discovered it yesterday. And they only condemn Antifa because they're fighting free speech. They're the real fascists, they'll say. It's difficult to even debate with them, which I really don't recommend at this point, except to mock them. They're not going to get it. They don't have their conception of language and politics and argument is so decayed and atrophied, you're not going to get very far. You make fun of them, throw a few one-liners, and that's probably all you're going to do. But, you know, initially I wanted to talk about the Lebanese situation. I wanted to talk about the surrender of the official U.S. surrender in Afghanistan. I wanted to talk about the fact that the U.S. has pulled out of every significant treaty concerning all of these things. You know, they simply sign something and they pull out of it unilaterally later on, meaning that no one trusts the U.S. internationally. They'll pull out of everything, acting as if they're a superpower. I was on the radio a few days ago when I, the Scorpio something, I don't remember what it was, good guys though, and I compared the American Empire to Mr. Burns from The Simpsons. Picture Mr. Burns losing. There've been episodes where he's lost his money. Picture him with no money, but he's still going to walk around Springfield giving orders, telling people what to do, you know, thinking that he has bodyguards, thinking that he has hounds to release. And when he doesn't, you suddenly feel sorry for the guy. He's just this broken, skinny man. That's how there's usually a Smithers around, of course, but just a few of them. Usually, when the U.S., it's not a superpower, not a military superpower, certainly not a financial superpower. It is crumbling and totally untrustworthy in the international stage and the domestic stage. The dollar is worthless. And yet they still do things and start wars and pick fights and use some of the few weapons they have, like these color revolutions, like intelligence, these corporate sanctions and everything else, which are being ignored all over the place, including by the same corporations who wrote them into law. And they do this without having any real authority. They do it without having any real backup. I wanted to talk about, now I have two articles I've published. I'm not going to get to these, but I had two articles published, one on Hezbollah Syria and the war against Greater Israel. And then the other one, as I just mentioned, is, the assassination of Rafiq Hariri in 2005, The Final Judgment, on my Patreon page. Normally, my Patreon page was really about articles concerning issues that I'm not normally known for, you know, music, art. So, but even there, because of the situation now, I'm not doing that very much. And I publish a lot of my international articles. I'm publishing so much now, I don't remember where I'm putting things. But for the most part, I have about maybe 10 books worth of stuff now on Patreon. And those two articles, they have a few things in common. Number one, they show the miserable failure of American foreign policy. Number two, they show, you know, Montgomery Burns with no money. That same kind of almost comic, he never really had much command in his voice. Even with money, he wasn't much of a superpower. And the U.S. is just spouting, you know, as if they're dominant, and they're nothing of the kind. The U.S. military is physically falling apart. Again, my Patreon page has article after article showing how the military apparatus in the U.S. is, I mean, physically falling apart. There's massive casualties with no report of them, including in government. You have to read. I have all kinds of translations from foreign. And sometimes Wikipedia, WikiLeaks, but sometimes foreign intelligence that I have access to, published, but not in English, that show massive casualties that the U.S. have taken that no one knows about. I mentioned the point of, during the Iraq War, the Pentagon ordered a massive number of body bags, and very briefly, the left, who still had this anti-war prejudice, which they're not anymore, pointed it out. And it was very quickly dropped. Conservatives didn't say a word. They'd know what it was for. You know, they claimed, well, the Chinese must have planted the story, whatever they said. But the truth is, it's because the casualty rate was very high and no one knows anything about it. They did. Those body bags were done because the Iraqis were beating them badly, at least for a while. the only way the U.S. won was, number one, to make sure that the Turks kept an army on the Iraqi border, so they had to split their army in half, and paying off Iraqi generals to abandon Saddam Hussein. Anyone who had a, you know, Mossad, you know, real, you know, picked out who had a beef with him and then would allow him to pay off, you know, escape, whatever, give him a mansion in London, whatever it is. And that's the only reason that the U.S. Won. And even the victory was hollow because the country's in pieces and has no economy. The other thing I want to talk about, and I haven't published this yet, is the U.S. surrender in Afghanistan, which is something, and I mentioned the whole idea of the U.S. being untrustworthy in the sense that they will sign a treaty, they'll make promises, they'll sign documents all over the world, and then immediately pull out of it. The surrender, and it was a surrender, in Afghanistan to the Taliban. Remember, there was a time when the Taliban wasn't even considered anything legitimate. We will never negotiate with them, and here you have a direct negotiation begging them not to attack the U.S. as they pull out. The so-called Doha Agreement, which was signed by Donald Trump. The deadline, of course, is coming up, May 1st, where all U.S. forces have to be pulled out of Afghanistan. It shouldn't surprise you that liberals and conservatives, precisely, both at the same time and using the same arguments, are condemning this agreement. Conservatives, of course, being what they are more concerned with feminism. They'll say that the rights of women will be immediately crushed. You know, they'll be objectified, you know, whatever nonsense they spout. Liberals will say the same thing. Biden, when Biden was coherent a few years ago, as vice president, he, you know, supported every war and condemned any. But even then, the U.S. military was saying, this is, we've been beaten, nothing we can do, you know, unless you send, you know, 10 times the forces we have there, which, of course, you can't because they were all over the world. We're going to lose this. And, of course, that's what happened. And so you have both sides of the make-believe political debate talking about this is a bad idea. A lot of it has to do with control over heroin, which the regime profits from amazingly. And remember, we need to be careful about using the energy argument. I've used this many times before, and there are certain parts of that are significant. But the United States gets almost no oil and gas from Central Asia and the Middle East. Natural gas, the U.S. is a huge producer. They don't get anything from there. Now the U.S. gets zero oil from the Middle East. Absolutely nothing. I think the only reason that the people who control Biden shut down the pipelines in the U.S. is to give the U.S. an excuse to keep its forces, making believe that we actually get oil from the Persian Gulf. Now, it is also true that American investors are part of the oil that goes to Europe from the Persian Gulf. But for the most part, you know, Russia, Norway, and even Canada are involved in Mexico supplying oil to Europe. The Middle Eastern oil pipelines go all over the world. They have an incredibly diverse base of customers. China, of course, is a huge one. And both Iran and Russia are very, and you know, places like, therefore, you know, Pakistan and Afghanistan have to be fairly stable for that to continue. So the U.S. can't even claim that this has anything to do with oil. The no war for oil nonsense that they were spouting in the early 90s was a deliberate lie. They knew the U.S. got almost nothing from the Middle East, even at the time. That was a way to avoid the whole Zionist issue. The only reason that the U.S. is there is to defend Israel. There's no other purpose. There's simply no other purpose. And the Israelis and the Mossad, ADL, these other groups will, AIPAC, created this notion of American oil dependence and that the Middle East was the only place they could supply. Most of us grew up believing that the U.S. is dependent on foreign oil, meaning, you know, Saudi or, you know, Iranian, whatever. Iraqi, of course, it's, you know, Iraq and Iran is at zero. I have no connection with the American market whatsoever. I'm not sure how sanctions work on a country like Iran that has minimal trade with the U.S. This is all purely symbolic. They can put pressure on banks and all the rest of it. The problem with Iran, of course, is that it is a first world economy, doing huge business with both Russia and China. The U.S. has been cut out of it. It's hard to tell billionaires where they can make their money. I don't care how liberal they are. They want to go where the cash is. Now, we've seen them deliberately lose millions and millions and millions for the sake of promoting an agenda, but that can't go on forever. You know, for example, the people who control the NFL or major, you know, entertainment, no one's watching their stuff anymore. They're losing a huge amount of money, but that stuff's not the only way they get their income. That's a small percentage of the elite's income. They could sacrifice that. You know, they'll destroy it if they need to. But this stuff is a little different. You know, even the energy that goes to Europe does have American investors. It's very difficult for them to be told, and they're seeing, you know, Russia, China, Iran, even, you know, India exploding economically. Even now, I mean, the Chinese economic growth post-COVID is tremendous, with actual production, unlike the U.S. Because of that, they're starting to get worried. Now, they'll use some of this stuff as an excuse to call in loans and bankrupt, you know, the middle class again. There is pretty much no credit as it stands. And the credit that exists is only going to the conglomerates and states and, you know, governments. Otherwise, small businesses, you know, even a subsidized loan is a problem. It still can be called in. And it's still not a huge portion of their balance sheet. Credit card debt isn't actually debt. It's based on the value that the signature, the promissory note, gives. That's only worthwhile if the economy is vaguely functional. If they fear that calling in loans will do nothing, that's a different story. And I'm predicting now that it's going to become very difficult to declare bankruptcy in the future, except for corporations. I rarely make predictions. That's one of them. They're going to make it, as it stands now, it's almost impossible. There's 200 documents you have to fill out precisely, or else it doesn't work. Therefore, you have to pay at least $2,000 for a lawyer to do it. That's as it stands now. They're going to make this more and more difficult as time goes on, making it almost impossible for the middle class to do this so they can start taking assets, which in the Great Reset is the whole concept. The whole Great Reset idea is going to eliminate bankruptcy by simply canceling debt, but in exchange, taking everything you have, allowing you to function using the so-called gig economy, rental. Everything is rentals. Everything's short-term. That's the plan. But when it actually gets put into force, the censorship's going to be overwhelmed. No one's going to really know what's happening. People are going to be losing things. But people were losing things 2008, 2009. People were losing homes, you know, by the millions all over the world. There was no one got upset. They had enough distractions. They had enough, make-believe issues someone will say something, you know, girls aren't good at math. And then that's what all the media attention will go on as millions of houses are repossessed. And they're doing it again. Inflation is the primary concern here. What the regime is going to do about that, I have no idea, except introduce a brand new currency, which has been done in the past. Inflation is massive. You can see that just at the grocery store, how they figure it. And I have an article on this I got from the great Paul Craig Roberts, one of the few sane people left, and he explains in detail how they manipulate the inflation numbers with the so-called basket of goods idea. There's something, you know, 100 of them, and 100 goods in there now. They simply change and manipulate and alter them in order to say that the prices are stable. They make assumptions about preferences and everything else. Not to mention the fact that the the dollar isn't worth much. So you'll actually have a real collapse, a real depression. And very few Americans will even know. They live in such a fantasy world. That's what the censorship is largely about. They have to actually live in a bubble, almost literally. And then we could do what we want. You know, if 2008, 2009, you had about 1 million bankruptcies a month. You had old people going back to work. You had pensions being stolen by the regime. You know, money doesn't disappear. It just changes hands. Massive bailouts for the millionaires, of course, and billionaires, as you say. Millions upon millions of repossessions of homes. Small businesses were devastated. And no one really got upset about it. No one got upset about the massive bailout with all this is going on. And the only explanation, of course, is Abulia, the fact that the American middle class is so worthless and broken that they can't do anything. They don't even understand the typical, you know, liberal conservative who are saying the exact same things right now are so mentally damaged that they don't really have ideas and they believe what they're told. It's very easy to take these people and put them in a bubble. They simply didn't know what was going on. So you can have a complete massive increase in white homelessness. You know, you go to Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, when I lived there for a long time, you had a massive homeless camp behind Walmart on Route 30. And, of course, the cops were sent in to smash it up. No one covered it, of course. And they kept, you know, this is, and no one talked about it. It wasn't even in the local paper. I saw it in my own eyes. Or the coverage was extremely minor and didn't make a big... It used to be homelessness was the number one issue in American politics in the late 80s. Now, no one talks about it. What was the last time you heard? Remember that homelessness was such this big issue in the late 80s, early 90s? That's all liberals talked about. I haven't heard any of these. It hasn't come up at all. But 15 years, I haven't heard it mentioned. And there, this is the reason for it. Why hasn't the ACLU said a damn thing about all this censorship and all? You know, I mean, we all know the answer to that. We all know how this goes. Now, your typical conservative will be calling on the ACLU. How come you guys aren't standing up for this? That's what you're supposed to do. Having no clue why that they don't care anymore. And it has to do with this, you know, dissolution. You know, they're not going to oppose the Bonapartist phase of the revolution. Their job was to destroy any kind of, you know, basic moral code in politics. And now it's been replaced with a new moral code, therefore they're going to shut their mouth. And who knows what these injections are going to do. Reprogramming people, God knows. I'm in no position to talk about that. Most of you are not either. But we all know it's probably not good. There's a reason the U.S. wants to start a war to keep the Russian vaccine out of Europe. And this is happening. The Czech Republic is, I can't get into it. The so-called explosion from 2014. All of this is being done. I mean, they're sending tanks now to keep the Russian vaccine from being distributed. Well, Big Pharma is extremely, but they're not that powerful. They're extremely powerful. They're not that powerful. There's something else. There's something else happening here. This vaccine has a lot more to it. And it sure has nothing to do with the virus. Well, as so often the case when I was a professor, I had a plan for a lecture that I didn't get to any of it. Because once you start talking about this, the destruction of American intellectual life, of any kind of ideological principle that's not dominated by the corporate state, you can't stop. It is so absurd. It is so easy to parody. It's laughable in the true sense, where there's really nothing else you can do but laugh. It's hard to talk about anything else. But there is this tight connection between the failure of American foreign policy and Israeli foreign policy, the bankruptcy of the Western world, on the one hand, and their extreme overreaction, censorship, violence, hatred, and domestically, there is a connection between those two things. And the idea of the modern conservative, this pathetic, broken, overweight, bad tie from the early 90s, group of people. And it's really hard to, they're like what Smithers is to Burns. That's kind of what the typical conservative is. And, this is, totally unprecedented. And getting to the very root of why this is the case is what I've been doing here for some time, what I'm continuing to do. But the connection between failure in foreign policy and the lashing out in domestic policy shows that there really is no big distinction between those two areas. And the dollar collapses, liberalism is going to collapse unless, of course, it has its Napoleon with a certain amount of power to enforce it. So anyway, thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.